Today we welcome Philip Marden to talk to us. You'll know Purnell Orchard, and he's going to explain where that name came from. And I was just commenting before that we haven't had too many orchardists or arable farmers talking to us. Well, it's Hastings and it's the Heratonga Plains, and it's part of our heritage, very much so. We have had pastoralists talk to us. But yeah, Philip, for that reason it's especially good to welcome you here. And you're not a Johnny-come-lately orchardist, because you tell me you're the third generation at Purnell, and it dates from about 1912. So we're looking forward very much to hearing you. Philip Marden.
Thank you. Well, look, I've written a little bit out to start with as an introductory, and then I was actually going to look at these pictures and talk about the industry and my involvement as we go through the pictures. But when asked by Peggy Van Ash if I would give a talk on the history of fruit growing in Hawke's Bay, I remembered that I had a copy of this book written by Rose Mannering. It was on our bookshelf at home, 100 Harvests. And by coincidence, I had also recently been given a copy of The 60 Miles of Fruit Trees, and that was given to me by John Williams. Just recently, you might know John Williams, written by Des Harris. That's the story of the Frimley Canning Factory. Both of these books have some fascinating accounts of the early days of fruit growing in this district, and if you have the chance to get hold of them or have a look, they really have some very interesting historical material in them. In a very readable way, 100 Harvests tells its story from the time the first apples were planted in 1840 to the first exports to London in 1892 and the establishment of the Hawke's Bay Fruit Growers Association, 1899. Up until 1999, when that book was published. My brother David was president of the Fruit Growers Association at that time, when that book was done, when we as an industry celebrated 100 years of fruit growing and of the Fruit Growers Association. The courage and optimism of those involved through the generations shines through. When you read bits out of this book, you can see it coming through. Neither droughts, floods, frosts, gales, hailstorms, pests and diseases, compliance laws and regulations, wars, nor trade policies diverted the overall forward momentum of the industry. Through the 100 years, the constant theme of seeking to improve fruit varieties, achieve better management and better marketing dominates. This is the industry that I have spent my life in, an industry that I'm proud to have been a part of. And this is my story. So I'll be talking to you from my perspective of the industry and how it's developed, changed, some things for the better, some things not, I don't think, over my lifetime. Our family history, as just was mentioned earlier, is on the third generation Marden to be involved in fruit growing. My grandparents came to this area in 1912. My grandmother was one of the lot. She was one of 12 children, three girls, nine boys. And the Lowes play a big part in the history of fruit growing in this region. Archie Lowe was one of the older ones. He had Sunnybank Orchard down near Stortford Lodge, opposite Sodios. And that's where Sunnybank Crescent, Lowe Street comes from. No orchard there now. And just if I can digress for a minute, talking about the Lowes, not this coming Sunday, but the next, there's this memorial service at St Matthew's for George Lowe. Yeah. And George was the person that was with Ed Hillary, you probably know him, but his second wife is actually out here now, staying with the younger brother Reuben. And there's a service next, as I said, at St Matthew's at 10 o'clock. However, we just came upon this book recently, and it's written by another chap, but taking all the letters that George wrote home over that time, well, it actually was a couple of years. Letters from Everest from George Lowe. Look, if any of you get the chance to get it and read it, it is a fascinating little book. Fascinating story, because George really was the unsung hero of the climbing of Mount Everest. I'm not taking anything away from Ed Hillary or Sherpa Tenzing, but part that George played in getting him up to the top was really fantastic. So I've got 30 odd pictures here, slides that were taken over a period of time. And just as we look at them, I was hoping to sort of cover areas like sprays and spraying, how things have changed picking and handling, and I brought along a few boxes. I know some of you will be familiar, some of you I know come from fruit and growing backgrounds, and you'll be familiar with these boxes and the labels, and it's just digressing again. It always amused me, because we only had the one label when we were exporting in wooden cases. And no matter what the colour of the fruit was in the box, we always had red apples on the end. I used to think, well, what a surprise. Those who opened the boxes in England or wherever, because in those days a lot of it went to England, and got green apples, because that's Granny Smith, or Ballarat, or Golden Delicious, but the label on the outside was red apples. Anyway, just a digression. So, packing and packaging, I'll sort of touch on, and some of the photos you'll see. Varieties, how they've changed, and the varieties that we used to grow, no longer. Marketing, I'll try and touch on a little bit about the Apple Pear Board, its rise and fall. The way the trees, especially the apple trees, how we grow the trees now. The shape of the apple trees, not so much change with stone fruit, but certainly with apples. And to a lesser extent, perhaps with pears. Personalities, there's some people in the industry that I'll try and remember that have really been great personalities over the years. I'll try and remember to give them a couple of funny little incidents. And frost control, I've written that down. And we seem to be getting more frost now out of season. And you'll have seen all the wind machines around. So those are the things that I was just sort of hoping to cover in the time available, and I'll probably go too long. You just tell me, because it's something that I've been involved with all my life, so I've got plenty of information. Okay, that photo was taken about 1961, and we've actually got that blown up, and it's in our cafe. I realise when I see it now how the one at home in our cafe has faded. But anyway, that's the old smoko. My mother was a great person to provide smoko. We were eating scones or something there, I think, cold winter day. And you'll see a bit of a wooden ladder. The old wooden ladders, they were a work of art. They were made out of white pine. And the Bixley family made those. They were very, very good ladders, but prone to breaking. Then we went to steel ladders, now aluminium. The shape of the trees, those are apple trees. Actually, I think that's a peach tree in the foreground there. And my dad is in the back there with the hat pulled down over his eyes. Some of you might remember Wilson's Pharmacy, middle of town by the State Theatre. The chap on the left is Michael Wilson, he's since died. And then this young chap here, young rural, he worked for us for many, many years. Has his own orchard now at Longlands. And my brother David on this end and myself in the middle. So the next one is pruning. I picked that out. I myself even laugh at that. One of us, and it might be myself, perched up there, pruning Cox's orange, I think they were. And you might see those are spaces. Wooden spaces that we used to put in to push the branches out to try and open the tree. Those were the days when we had big multi-litre, strong rootstocks, multi-litre trees. Nowadays we don't have that anymore. We've got much, much smaller trees. The next one, and pruning, those are WBC, William Moncretian pears, that block's gone now, and a hydrolator. And so I wanted to touch also on the part that hydraulics have played in the industry in my lifetime, how we now have hydro ladders, which are a fantastic machine for the work that they do. We use them the whole year round. And we have hydraulic pruners, cutters, that are hooked on. We run ours on LPG to see the gas bottle there. But because they're hydraulic, you can hook in these hydraulic cutters, which make pruning so much easier. We still use second gears and a saw, but for those bigger cuts, they're in between, it's just so much easier. You've got to watch, you don't cut your fingers, but they really are a great machine and a great help. I mean, we use them for picking, for thinning, and as you see there was pruning. But forklifts, you know, just coming back to hydraulics, how when my brother David and I left school, or even before we left school, when we came home from school, our job was to stack up the cases that had been picked in the orchard and then cart them up to the shed. Everything picked into old bushel, old kerosene cases, and then lifted manually onto a trailer and taken up and stacked in the shed. A hang of a lot of manual work. Nowadays, the fruit's picked into bins, as you probably all know, and then transported up the shed with a mini lift on a tractor, and then the forklifts in the yard, they can do all sorts of things. But I was thinking last night too, bin dumpers, where each case used to be tipped out at the end of the old Bensman graders, and now the bins are pushed under the water because the apples float. Pears are a bit more difficult because they don't necessarily float. they're denser. So they float out, and that's all done with hydraulics, the hydraulic rams. So as you can see, I'm just trying to point out that hydraulics have really played a very, very important part. Okay. Now that's just taken about 1961 as well, in Parkway Road, just in off Parkway Road. Very wet winter. We had 1955 and 61 were very, very wet winters. And we as an industry around the district lost a number of trees, especially stone fruits. Peaches don't like wet feet. And a lot of trees have been planted on marginal land. And it was a dark winter day, it had rained like hell, and it was early, like 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning after a very wet night. And just show you the water that was lying there. Those are Granny Smith trees. Again, look at the growth on them, the one-year-old growth, upright. Our pruning methods now are just so different to those days. I look back and think, what the hell, we know. The changes, the way we pruned, we cut the trees so much, and it made them grow even more. But the other thing I was going to say was the fact that tile draining has made all the difference. Now, there was a chap that worked for the MAF in those days, or the Department of Agriculture, Selwyn Wilson. Some of you may have known. Talking about George Lowe, I think that this chap, Selwyn Wilson, was one of the unsung heroes of our region in the work that he did in designing tile draining for all the areas that were suffering from wet feet. Because, as I said, there was a lot of trees died. And the React family, with their new machinery that put the tile pipes into their clay pipes, they were made up in Wairoa. They used to come down by rail. And we used to go down to the railway station and cart them home out of the big open trucks. I think that factory in Wairoa was long gone. But there were thousands of metres, or probably almost hundreds of miles, of tile drains put in over a period of years under the design of the Selwyn Wilson, which was done free through the MAF. You paid for the tiles, of course, and you paid for the drainage contractor to do it, but they were experts in their field. And it really made a big, big difference to where we could grow fruit trees in the district, and the loss is now minimal from wet feet. That's just a shot of a Wintonellis pear tree. That's actually down at Sunnybank, which is the Lowe family. And I mentioned earlier about the Lowes. I digressed a wee bit but that's on the original Lowe property. The Lowe family, there was lots of the brothers, my dad's uncles, who settled around the district, and Jock Lowe was out this way. Some of you will remember Jock. So they played a very important part sort of over the war years. And that's just a shot of Black Doris plums. And I put that one in because of you folk, the Lay family. And we used to supply the Wyona canneries with Frank Lay, which was your uncle. You know where they were down on Napier Road. And we supplied them for a long, long time with Golden Queen peaches and Black Doris plums. Those trees have long gone, but we still grow Black Doris in another block, and we supply Watties now. So that's just a shot I put in of bees. I used to keep a few bees. I've got a veil on there. I wasn't too fussed on stings. The old chap on the left was a part-time, just a hobbyist beekeeper, but the stings didn't worry him. It's his son leaning over the rail on the left. And my sister Joyce, who has since died, looking on a little bit further back away from the bees. Well, we're just having a look to see how they were doing. But after some years, I started to get more reaction from bee stings, so I gave it away. Now we've got the Varroa mite. Now that's Golden Queen peaches in flower. And I put that in because of the oil pots. Those of you who remember the days when we had frost control. Well, we didn't have the frost control methods that we have now. And so there's the black oil pots there. And many of you will remember the smog and the smoke we used to get. But, you know, they saved the crops, but we've progressed from there. The next one, I think, is one that I took. That's taken at night with the pots going. And I moved the camera a tiny bit. We always thought that looks like in the old pounds. Many ways it was relevant because of the cost of the fuel when you lit, how much it cost for burning the fuel was in pounds then. You can almost see the sort of smoky area. And in the morning there was smoke everywhere.
Thick black smoke.
And most of the time you'd get a westerly drift and it would move out to sea. But occasionally there'd be a little bit of an easterly, get back up and blow it back in. It was hell to play then. One of our earlier sprayers, air blast sprayer, but of course if you go back, the spraying was done originally with horse-drawn little units, pulling a little tank and a pump. Then it went to tractors, pulling pump, and the launchers would spray the trees with a handgun. There's a story, I remember this story was told by Ken Kittle. Some of you will know Ken Kittle, who became the chairman of the Appen Pier Board. He had orchards down, and the family still have orchards down off River Road. Ken only died a year or something ago. And Ken told the story that when he first bought his orchard, and his wife Marion, that he was spraying, she was driving the tractor. In those days, most of us had clean cultivation under the trees. We didn't have grass. We've changed now to having grass. But anyway, so Marion was driving the tractor, and Ken was at the back spraying the trees. And the idea was that you would call out to the driver to move up a bit each time. It was a hot morning, and Marion was wanting to do other things at home, and she was out on this tractor. So Ken called out, "Move up!" And she was half asleep, and she didn't move. And he called out again, about two or three times he called. And so in frustration, he picked up a clod of dirt and threw it. The idea was that he was going to hit the tractor and whack her up to move up, because he hit her. And so she got so wild, she got off the tractor and said, "Do your spraying yourself," and went home. So poor old Ken then had to, or nothing more frustrating than getting on the tractor, shifting it up a bit, spraying, getting off. So I thought that was an amusing one to tell. So then we went to that sprayer there. And that, I put that in because that's our original home way of the back, which has since been shifted. But in the early days, my early days, we grew a lot of tomatoes when the trees were small, when we had planted this new block. We grew tomatoes for Watties, and we had a very heavy crop. But just going back to that photo there, that was just to show you innovation of how we sprayed the plants, because we weren't geared up for cropping. But however it worked, see, there's a plant stuck in under there. But then see the chap on the back, he's spraying the row that we're struggling with, and the other one's being sprayed. And by the look of it, I would guess it was copper. Because the other thing, these changes there have been in the sprays and the spraying methods. But the sprays we used to use in those days, and some of you remember Blackleaf 40, some nicotine sulfate. Terrible stuff. Arsenate of lead. Terrible thing. See my brother David there, that was probably copper, which wasn't quite so bad, but arsenate of lead was a terrible thing. But that was for the control of cod and moth. Nowadays we've got onto this IAP program. Cod and moth and leaf roller there, and it's so totally different. We're now reliant on, well, what we're trying to do is create a situation in the orchards that encourages the predators, and so many new predators have been introduced, so we're trying not to put any sprays on that will affect the life cycle of the predator, because that's our first line of defence, and it's so different now and so much better than it was years ago. Load of tomatoes, Alec Corns, a well-known carrier. One of the Corns is from the Corns family, orcharding people in Oak Avenue. All loaded up there by hand. That's why I'm short, long arms. Loading these damn tomatoes. One year we did 12,000 cases of tomatoes in the Watties. That's just a photo of early peaches and plums on our old trailer. When we were picking peaches or stone fruit, we used to pick and pack in the orchard. And there's a wooden tray I've got here. We still use the wooden trays in our shop. But when we were sending them away to markets, the stone fruit went away in the old 7x7, this case here. You orcharding people remember that one. It was a terrible thing to pack, very difficult. But they're all the same length, the same footprint in a way as the bushel case. And there's a pear case there. Pears are heavier, so the box was a little bit shallower. But these things were sent away. The best fruit was sent away in trays, and the slightly not poorer quality, the next grade was sort of sent away in these. And it was all railed from the Hastings station, and therein lies the story. But this tray here, they were wired together in threes as a crate, and cleats on the end, because sometimes you've got bigger peaches, or your mammy peaches, you added a bit on here by the cleat, nailing the cleat on, so that the next tray didn't bruise the other ones. And then they were put in sets of three and wired together. Hard work dealing with these wires. Just quickly, I just wanted to say, just an idea of the peaches that we used to grow, and some of you will remember some of these varieties long gone. Sneeds, a little white peach that ripened before Christmas. Levecchia, do you remember the Levecchia? Pizerni, which those are. Another one very similar, Briggs Red May, which are white fleshed. Lovely peaches, but hard to grow. Buttercup. Wiggins, any of you remember the old Wiggins peach, which was a lovely white peach? Carmen, Anderson Seedling, Mary's Choice, Kalamazoo, and then a peach called Million Dollar. Its real name was J.H. Hale, but it was called the Million Dollar Peach. It was bred in America. And it was interesting in the cannery book, the Frimley Cannery, they grew mostly Kalamazoo and Mary's Choice before the Golden Queen peach came along. And then a very late peach called Kahuraniki, which was a terrible thing. Plums, Duff's Early Jewel, Billington, Coe's Golden Drop, Doris, the ordinary Red Doris, which came out before Black Doris, and then Omega, some of them we still grow a lot of, Satsuma, some of you might remember those varieties. And then after we went from picking in the orchard in bushel cases, the move was to go to bulk handling. Now, before we went to these big trailers, we actually went to a big bin, if you ladies were remember them, and that was with the advent of hydraulics, you could lift them or they were put on a trailer. Then we went to these trailers, and that's my brother David and his eldest daughter Rosalind, towing two trailers which held about 90 bushels of fruit. And we picked into those. They were towed up to the shed and then tipped up slightly, and the fruit slid out onto a conveyor belt before it went up onto the grader. So that was another step in the process over the years of going to water before we had the water dumping system perfected. When you put your first bag of apples in them, you'd think, well, you'll never fill this up. That's so debilitating with such a big area to fill. But when we got to Granny Smith's, and we grew a lot of grapes over the years, we had a chap that used to come over from Queensland. He was a cane cutter. In the days when a lot of the cane over there was cut. And he'd come over here for the apple season, and he was a fantastically good picker. He could fill three of those a day. And he picked well. I mean, it wasn't as though he bruised the fruit. He was a very, very hard worker. Obviously, to fill three of them a day. He'd start, you know, at the crack of dawn, and he's still there just about when it was getting dark.
Well, what would he be paid then? Would he be on contract?
Yes, he would have been, yeah. But he made good money.
Yes.
But he worked hard for it. He worked hard for it. I really can't remember how much it was. Now, that's a crop of sturmer. You remember the sturmer apple? Those trees are long gone, and they're the old vase shape. It's a bit hard to tell there, but that was a very nice block. And when my dad bought that block, which is in the home part of Parkway Road, they were there. And that particular little property was owned by a chap McNab, and that was another well-known Twyford name. McNab's had a lot of orchards in Twyford. There's a McNab Road. And that block adjoins my grandparents' block, the 10 acres that my grandparents, and I missed to say in the beginning, that when they came here in 1912, it was great uncle Archlow, George's father, who sussed out this block for my grandparents. My grandfather was a flaxman, really, and he moved up from the South Island into the Palmerston North area where they were flaxmen, and that didn't go well, that venture, and then they came up. This Archlow said, come on up here, I'll look for a piece of land, and this piece of land had 2 acres of fruit. My grandfather wasn't really a fruit grower, and it was my mum and dad that really got the whole place going. The two properties are joined, and we ended up with about 17 acres. Probably sounds a bit convoluted, but and then we expanded from there. But this was on the original piece on Parkway Road. They were very heavy cropping, those old sturmers. But now we struggle to sell. We've got two trees of sturmer, and we struggle to sell them. You know, they're just not popular, not known. The other thing I probably forgot to say was that the name Purnell of our orchard came from my mum and dad's names, which were Percy and Nell. Some people think that's our surname. We get called Mr. Purnell. Now that's off the top of our packing shed roof, because there was a thunderstorm out to the north of us and probably had hail in it. My daughter and I put these together the other night. She said, did you actually get hail out of that? And I said, I don't think so. I think we missed. But we didn't miss every time. As you know, the hail can do a terrific lot of damage in a very short time. You know, one side of the road can get hail and the other side misses. And my brother David was president of the association at the time of this huge hail storm that the district had in 2004, I think it was. And that took out half of the crop, the apple crop. We missed by a whisker. We were just down the road. We got heavy rain. But no hail. And yet the next orchard down the road, Butte Orchard, going back toward town, got hail. And then from there on, virtually all of that side of the town, this was in very early March, I think, or late February, we just got underway with the gala. And the damage was just devastating. I'd never seen hail damage. I mean, it knocked pieces of bark off the trees. Not only damaged, but the fruit was just minced in the areas that got it worse. So hail can do a lot of damage. We can take our hail insurance, but it's a bit dicey. But anyway, that's why I put that in. And there's a shot of our newer packing shed. Just gives you an idea of the wooden cases. I think we were packing pears. The pears are in a bin. That's when we first went into bulk handling. Before we went to trailers, the bins put up on a stand, and boards in the front just there are pulled out, and the fruit flows down onto the old Benjamin grader. Remember the Benjamin graders? And there's two people there packing. Dad, I suppose, up there grading. And down here, there's somebody working with the lidding machine and wiring, because all the cases were wired. Export cases, that was a terrible job. There's the roll of wire there. And we had two different machines for wiring. Remember the old one with the wind handle, and then you cranked it up to tighten the wire? You could never buy the machine. We had to hire it. Can't think of the name of the company, they were Jewish. So that you had to buy their wire. But the original machine that you pulled up tight was probably the better one. Then we went to a slightly different one where you pulled the handle over and then back. And then as sure as hell, if you didn't get it right, it would break. And then you'd have to go round again with the wire. It was very, very hard on your thumb.
Gerard,
that was the name of it. Yeah, so there was a lot of handwork. And if they going to Carson's, which we did in later years, and it was a great move, because if any of them fell down, they'd splinter and break, and the fruit would be damaged. And I used to think, heck, I wonder with the way they were packed and the pressure on them. And then the loading in the truck with a forklift, but before we got to that, we loaded the truck by hand. All the cases were stacked on the truck, taken into town to the Apple and Fairborn Depot on Woodkeen Street, and offloaded by hand again, every case. And I can still hear the noise of steel conveyors with the rollers, and they'd go whizz. And the cases would whiz along into the depot where they were stacked into the cook store before being shipped out, taken out by truck, and then over to Napier. And of course the wharfies, you know, each layer was put in the hold of the ship. They'd put planks down most of the time, and some of the times they wouldn't. They'd walk all over the boxes, so no wonder they got to England, they were bruised. The carton made a fantastic difference with the fibre trays, the Friday trays as they were called. The Friday, that was a bit confusing there. It was a patent taken out in America by the people that designed this. I'm sure you know what I mean, those moulded paper mache trays. Their name was a German name, and they Englicised it to the name Friday. But that was a bit confusing, because people used to hear think, why is it called a Friday? And why have we got a Thursday or a Wednesday? But it was just the tray. There's the carton up there, and the trays fitted inside, and we packed into them, and that made a terrific difference. That was just a shot of some, I think those are Granny Smith's again, 02. Each of the varieties had a number. We've got one case missing there, I'm not sure why. They were always stacked on their side with the cleats at the end. I mean, the writing was the other way, but that's how they were stacked on a pallet. That chap, that Sid Carrington, worked for us for many, many years. A well-known family from over the Frimley, Twyford area, Carringtons. And he put on this funny little hat. Anyway. Just to give you an idea of that. And that's loading. When we transitioned from the days when we loaded by hand, then to forklifts, and pretty primitive, but they worked, and there was attachment on the back of a tractor, which made it very difficult to load. But it was a move away from loading by hand. And then they were offloaded by more sophisticated forklifts and went into the back of the Pebble Depot. That's our old packing shed. And then we went into a new packing shed, and we imported a new grading system from America. My brother David built a lot of the equipment. Those ladies there, some of those ladies had worked for us for many, many years, obviously Granny Smith's, and grading. We don't pack our own export fruit. Now, we still pack local market, but some years ago, before the demise of the Apple and Pear Board, the Apple and Pear Board went through a lot of changes, and unfortunately, we were encouraged to, well, the CEO at the time thought there were far too many pack houses and they would be better off with bigger pack houses, and they brought into place lots of regulations which made it difficult for smaller pack houses. And so at that time we decided we would not upgrade, we had to go to colour sorting and all sorts of things. So we gave up packing export fruit, and it was the wrong thing to do, we realised afterwards. However, that's just a shot in the pack house at the time, the other end where the cartons. In those days we used to make up the cartons, the inner and the outer. There was a walkway up above, up in here. You walked along and hung the inner and the outer, which was pushed in together on like a washing machine above the packer. The packer would reach up and pick the carton off the hook up above, pack into it, and then the carton would come along. You can just see the sun coming along there. They were all wrapped, that was Granny Smith, wrapped in purple oil paper, because Granny Smith had a bad habit in those years of developing a disorder which came about with cool storage called scald. And the paper was impregnated with an oil base, and it was very nice to wrap the fruit, because everything was wrapped in those days. And by wrapping it with this oil paper, purpley coloured oil paper, it prevented this disorder. We went away from that because we drenched the fruit before it went into the system with a chemical which stopped scald anyway, because the cost of paper was very, very high. It was produced at Carwell by the Caxton people, so that cut a lot of cost. So now there's nothing wrapped at all. So the packer would then put the carton on the conveyor, and you can't see there, but it came around and it was glued up. The bottom and the top were glued by hot melt gluers when it went through this gluing machine. I put that in because, well, talking about hydraulics and forklifts, that was a little forklift, the forks aren't on it, David made that up, from a little unit that some of you will remember when the railway line went over the River Tuckers, the old line that went over the top, and then the River Tucker Tunnel was put through. And when it was finished, they sold off some of the equipment that was no longer used, and these little units were used in the tunnel. I think they had a little bucket on the front. I think they sold it by Tina, and he got this little unit and converted it into a forklift. As I said, it was in the process of being converted. So that was our first little forklift. Nowadays they're much more sophisticated, but it worked. It was better than the old attachment on the back of the tractor. Hang on, a lot better, because you were sitting and looking at it. When the other way, you were looking behind you, which was darn difficult. And that's just to show the importance of water. I mean, way back I showed you the one of too much water when we had trouble with excess rainfall. But of course, like this last summer, we've had a very dry summer, which actually suits. We like dry summers, as long as we've got plenty of water. Where we are, we're lucky. We're not too far away from the Narrowa River. And that was putting a well down. You can see the water, it just got into a good flow. And the well is in under there. My dad's standing there watching. Myself, I think it's either me or my brother David, I think it's me. And see the water coming out the top here, going around. So that well went down about 150 feet or 40 metres. And, you know, this last summer was pretty dry, but from our point of view, we still had plenty of water. It hardly changed even in the dry condition. So we've got a lot of the orchard under permanent irrigation, which is the little sprinklers, which is a much more efficient way, but it's expensive to put in. We still do quite a lot of the orchard with movable aluminium pipes, which are more labour intensive, but it's the next stage into going into permanent irrigation. And then to finish off, I thought I'd put a few in. Some of you will remember that we used to do floats, natural blossom floats, for the Blossom Festival. Well, when my brother David and I left school and came home, my dad had been very keen to buy a 21-acre property next door to us, which he finally managed to do, but he had to pay a very, very high price for it per acre at the time. It was a record price to get this because, you know, the property right next door to you is always more convenient and cheaper piece, but he did pay a lot of money for that at the time. And we had some luck go our way. As I said, we were growing tomatoes for Watties. We had a very good crop, good summer, not dry. Because they'd had a huge crop, everybody had a big crop of tomatoes. We were not a regular grower, although my dad knew James Watty before he came, sir, because he grew up just around the corner from us, he being Sir James Watty. So the next year we couldn't get a contract for tomatoes, so Dad got enough potato seed, and we planted 10 acres of potatoes. They were the variety Auckland, the short top, which was Sutton. Some of you might remember the old variety, the forerunner to Rua. In those days, a lot of table potatoes for the country were grown in Canterbury. And nowadays, Canterbury tends to grow more just seed potatoes. But there'd been a glut of potatoes. There was potatoes you could hardly give away. So a lot of folk didn't bother to grow potatoes the next year. They'd been so hard done by. Dad managed to get some seed of the supper variety and thought, well, seeing we can't grow tomatoes or plant potatoes. This is in this property next door before we were progressively planting it in trees. And my dad had seen the fact that Granny Smith was such a good apple. He felt, you know, there wasn't enough of them, and the Apple and Pear Board were paying good money for Granny, so we planted 10 acres of Granny's eventually, which was a lot in those days. However, this crop of potatoes, we ended up with 100 tonne of potatoes, and that was harvested in 1956. Some of you might remember, we went from one extreme to the other. That year, there was a famine of potatoes because nobody hardly planted them. And we came by luck on this 100 tonne of potatoes, and he sold them for £100. We had people coming in off the road begging us, please, will you sell me a bag of potatoes? And so from that, we were able to just about pay off this property and buy a decent tractor, because we'd had the old Case tractor. You might have seen the photo of Tony the Sprayer. My brother Dave and I made do with gear that was really antiquated. So we were able to buy a decent tractor. So this float, what I'm coming to, we decided we'd have a go at putting a natural blossom float in the procession. So those two girls in the front are twins, and they're Martins. Their dad had a little orchard down the far end of St. Andrew's Road. Some of you might remember. Their dad was a relative, of course, but he was a Second World War pilot in the tail end of the Battle of Britain. Came back home to New Zealand and got involved with top dressing. He was one of the pioneers, Sleas Martin, of top dressing with Sherwoods. He was a tiger moth pilot, because that's what they used in those days. So he made enough money to buy this little orchard down the end of St. George's Road. So they're twin girls and my sister Joyce up the top. Now most of those flowers in here, anemones, not all, but we glued them on to a cardboard base. We sort of used hedging to cover the tractor and then put daffodils around. We did it the evening before, and on the way to town, this new tractor with big lugs on the tyres, bump, 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 all the way to town, and it was a trail of daffodils. So we learned a lot of things. We got third prize, but they looked all right for them. So we learned, and that was the best float that I felt that we ever did. And that was actually pushed, you can't see there, but my brother David is way down in here, underneath there, and he's steering it. With a tiller, steering. There was a young lady sitting here. I didn't have a photo looking at it from the front, but I was in the little house, and my wife, Sharon, and there's a little fountain. And I wound a winder with a pump, and that made the water circulate and made the fountain go. And then we also had a bee smoker with a sacking in it, and Sharon, my wife, puffed the smoke out the chimney. So we're down there, we're going down the street, there'd be a puff of smoke coming out. However, as I said, it was actually pushed. There was a long pipe rod back here. A friend of ours, it was Frank Cooper. Some of you know Frank Cooper, the land agent fellow, at least you're down Havelock way. Frank and Kay we knew well, and Frank had a little old Land Rover. Those of you will remember those days of George Wilder, famous escape artist. They couldn't keep in. So we decorated this old Land Rover with bits of manuka and made a little hut inside to cover the camp, sort of, and we called it Wilder's Lodge. And so Frank drove that, actually pushed, and he was in communication with the telephone down to David in the front steering. So we had a lot of fun. We actually had more fun in some ways decorating the old Land Rover than we did with the other. But however, we did learn a lot, and we learned which flowers to put where. Those flowers on the roof of the little building, those are camellias, and they're all wired on. You know, the forest wire, pushed the forest wire through. Started the afternoon before, and then gave it a wee twist. It was on netting. So we had tons of enthusiastic helpers. In fact, it became difficult because we had lots of people that were so enthusiastic helpers, and they would argue about which flowers, which colour. Oh no, that colour won't go there. We should put something else, but natural flowers, it didn't matter. They sort of blended in with one another. It was more a matter of learning which flower to put where. The daffodils with the long stem could go on flat surfaces. They were easy on flat surfaces, but on the wall, because the stem held them down, the weight of the stem. There's Laconaria in there. That's a close-up of the daffodils and grape hyacinths.
Did you grow all the flowers?
No, we didn't, but we got to the stage where people would offer them. They'd bring us up, and we'd put them in the course, and we'd start collecting flowers about a week beforehand. Dad used to go all around. We had people that came from Central Hawke's Bay. We had one family actually from Shannon that used to come up and help us and bring flowers from down there. I think the very last float that we ever did, we had an excess. We had some left over. We used to start about lunchtime-ish, Friday before, and I think the M'lady's Garden one, we had pretty near done by 10 or 11 o'clock at night, something like that. A bit of titivating in the morning. That's just a shot in the cool store, the old kerosene, and just all sorts of flowers put in the cool store. And it's amazing how, especially daffodils, how long they last. I mean, they only had to last that day, and that isn't much after that.
How did you work out your designs?
That's a good question. Sort of as we went. As we went, in a way. I had a bit of an idea, and then sort of spend the nights in the winter, starting in July. My brother-in-law, Don, who's married to my sister, Joyce, was a carpenter by trade, not that that mattered, but he helped us a lot. So it was just a sort of an idea, and then we'd develop it as we went along. And that's the very last one that we ever did. And unfortunately, I didn't put in the one of that completed. That was Castles in the Air. And it was a castle-y thing up the back, up high. And two girls that worked for us sat in the front. But that's just starting. That was a bridge-y thing that went up. And that was camellias. The white camellias, we must have just made a pattern there and filled them in with the red ones. The red ones are plenty of them around. Then I just put that on because there was a slide that I had. That was taken in Norton Road. The traction engine, it's hard to believe that that would have been about in the 60s. I would say they were thrashing grass seed, probably rye. And you can see there's a bloke up there at the top, feeding it in. And another one there stacking the bags of grass seed just down here. So there's a bit of history there. And then to finish off, I put that in because that's taken down at the, what everybody used to say, the Parkaway River, which wasn't bridge, it was the Narrara River, but at Parkaway, where the old bridge, and the old bridge is still there, where the country park is. That was the favourite swimming hole, and you know, on some Sunday afternoons, there'd be several hundred people down there. And we used to go down, pester our parents, the days before swimming pools, can we go down to the river for a swim? And there's a rope over there, and the person just swinging off the cliff bank into the water. In a hot, hot summer, especially like the summer we've had, the water would be actually quite almost warm. But still, it was a marvellous place to go to finish off a hard day's work. And just along the wee bit further down there, that's where the cold spring came in, which is the Turnakuri Waimate, which comes from away up through Parkaway right up to Fern Hill. And spring-fed water comes into the river further up now, it's all changed, but in those days it came into the river down there, and the water coming in was freezing cold. You swim across there and get across the cold street. So I think that's about it. If I can just finish off by saying that, you know, one of the sad things of the industry is that my brother David and I were great supporters of the Acton Fair Marketing Board, and we lost that organisation 12 or 13 years ago. So we went from single desk marketing of apples to the next year when the legislation was removed by the government of the day, we went from largely one export. There were times when they gave consents to other people to export into places where there was no competition from them. We went from that to about 90 exporters. And we look at the industries that have done so well over the years since then, like the kiwi fruit industry and the dairy industry. The dairy industry is slightly different, admittedly, but largely single desk. We've got enough competition, we always felt, out there without competing against ourselves. And so we found it sad that back in those days, in the 60s, 70s, there was something like 1,500 growers in New Zealand. Now there's about 450 or something like that. But the production is nearly, it did drop a lot, but it's come up a little bit. So we've got the advent of big corporate growers and sadly the demise of a lot of smaller growers. We used to pack, as I said earlier, our own fruit and pack for about another 6 or 7 growers. And they will lease their properties or pull them out. So that's one part of the industry that I find sad. In the days of the Apple and Pear Board, it was such a cooperative industry. Keane Kittle was a person who I had great admiration for. Because he helped to develop the cooperative nature of our industry, where everybody helped each other. And I think a lot of that came from the post-war years where there were a lot of young people that came back from the war, rehab orchardists, settled on rehab blocks, the Grassmere block was one that was cut up. And so there was very much a cooperative spirit. In those days, the local market was controlled as well. And there was black marketing went on. That was where we were not allowed to sell to a retailer. Now, that side of it was given away, and that couldn't be sustained. We knew that. But from an export point of view, it was sad that we lost the single desk marketing. That's my opinion, and my brother David, and there are others in the district too. Whether we'll ever get back to that, I don't know. But it was sad to see that there were things about the Appleton Pier Board that were not going right. But instead of fixing them, the industry, they were all saying that they threw the baby out with the bathwater and suffered since. And we've had difficulties with marketing and the high dollar and climatic changes as well, to a certain extent, more frost. This last spring, Labour weekend, we had a really nasty frost. We had several others earlier, but we had a very nasty frost. And we got caught very badly. We did a lot of damage to the apple crop. But however, we battle on, we're optimists. And I've got a son on the property. He threatens to leave every 2 or 3 days. But he's still here. So here we are, thank you.
That's been a classic morning, hasn't it? Rose is going to give a vote of thanks in a minute. Let's do that.
Yes, I'd just like to thank you so much. It's been a real nostalgic journey for my sister and I. We grew up in a small orchard in Crosses Road, and everything's so full of memories for us. I remember I used to get paid a penny a case to paste these labels on each chair. And you could make good money if you spent the whole day in it.
A shilling or 2 shillings.
This is an identification number for which grower it was. This was to do with the size or the variety?
No, variety.
And then you put a little stamp on the end to show. I could go off. It was just wonderful to hear all that and the blossom festival. And I was so impressed that you made fresh flower floats. Before I finally finished with Philip, I think you should write a book too. Although 100 Harvests is wonderful. Just those little stories about people that you told. So we're most grateful. Thank you very much.